Hi and welcome to the Movies You Love podcast, the podcast where every week, I've done it again, guys. I started out this podcast going, I'm going to do this every 2 weeks, and once again, a week out from the last episode, I'm posting again. Can we call this a Christmas miracle or something? I don't know, but I'm going to accept it that way. I hope you will as well. It's going to be the podcast once again every week. We don't know if we're going to switch back to every other week soon enough, where I get to sit down and talk with all sorts of interesting writers, film critics, and just general interesting people across the internet as we sit down and talk about the movie that helped them fall in love with movies. And this week on the podcast, I have brought on Christopher Runyon, a writer and critic for MovieMezzanine.com, as well as a host of the CineEffect podcast, which you can go find on CineEffect.wordpress.com. This week, Chris asked us to talk about the 1980 film directed by Stanley Kubrick, The Shining, a film which I'm pretty sure means a lot to a lot of people out there, as most Kubrick films do. But it becomes an interesting topic, a point of topic, where we end up talking about, you know, movies that we watched during our childhood, our parents' control of our viewing habits, and also the craziness that ensues when that moment of life comes where that movie hits us, which is kind of the point of all these podcasts. And it's kind of great. Thank him for coming on and talking to me. And I'm just going to let us just fall into the podcast right now. So, go.
Well, you know, Doc, when something happens, it can leave a trace of itself behind. Say, like, if someone burns toast, well, maybe things that happen leave other kind of traces behind. Not things that anyone can notice, but things that people who shine can see. Just like they can see things that haven't happened yet. Well, sometimes they can see things that happened a long time ago. I think a lot of things happened right here in this particular hotel over the years. And not all of them was good.
What about room 237?
That's the fun thing about this podcast. I can just start like right now and just say this is the beginning and say hi, Chris. See, that's the fun thing. The way I cut this together, I can just do that. Hi, Chris. I'm so happy you've joined me because this week you have decided to talk about the wonderful 1980 film by Stanley Kubrick, The Shining. And I'm going to take a gander. Is that even the correct word? I do not know. I'm going to take a guess that you were not in the theater for its debut in 1980.
No, it was before my time.
It was before literally. Your time. So I'm
yeah,
going to...
That's how young I am.
That's how young you are. Don't worry, it's before my time as well. It's a little bit before my time. I'm not... I might be older than you, but I'm not that much older.
You're probably older than me. I'm going to guess.
When was the tell me about the first time you actually saw this movie, and tell me a little bit about what brought you to the movie, your experience with it, and how you might have changed a little bit before and after.
Oh my, so this is an interesting little story, because I've always, you know, loved watching movies, and I would go to the theater a lot with my mom and my little sisters and everything. But the thing is, I wasn't allowed to watch rated R movies for a while. All of my friends were allowed to watch R-rated movies, so they were geeking about, oh, how awesome The Matrix was, and yet I'd be sitting there like, I don't know what The Matrix is, you guys. I don't. It wasn't even until I was 12 years old that I saw my first R-rated movie, and it was, most people say that their first R-rated movie is something like Terminator or Die Hard or something like that. I watched those later. My first R-rated movie is Roman Polanski's The Pianist. So, it kind of scarred me a little bit, because it was the first time I saw someone like get shot in the head and like blood and brains came out and everything. And also like Nazis, you know, that's that. And like that was my first R-rated movie. And all of a sudden I started because of that, a whole new world of cinema opened up for me, and I just started, like, watching a bunch of stuff that were parent-approved. But, and then I saw, like, you know, the DV for The Shining, and I said, hey, we should watch this, and she's like, no, you can't watch that yet. And I'm like, why not? And she's like, because it's a horror movie. And the thing is, like, back then, another thing that I didn't do a lot of is watch horror movies. And can we swear?
Go right ahead, no problem.
I was a total pussy when I was, before I was 12. I was just a total pussy and everything scared me. Like, I remember getting nightmares from just watching commercials for The Grudge, which is really silly now that I look back, and I've watched so much gory shit now. But, I believe that the first, this isn't even considered a horror movie, but I consider the first horror movie I watched was Steven Spielberg's War of the Worlds, which is the closest that Spielberg has made to a horror movie, aside from Jaws. And that movie was like a really thrilling thing, and it got me on the edge of my seat. And that was kind of the first time I sort of felt that. And I still really love War of the Worlds. I have a soft spot for it. And because of that, I thought I could take horror movies now. So I started watching a bunch that I never saw before, like The Sixth Sense and so on and so forth. I can't remember all of them right now because there were a lot. But yeah, this leads into The Shining, which my mom was still telling me, no, you can't watch that yet. So then one day I was home alone and I was like looking through just channels on, you know, cable, all of the movie channels like Showtime, HBO, and I saw that The Shining was on there, and I was gonna watch it, but then I saw, you know, my parents were coming in, so I basically DVR'd it, and I saved it, and I saved it for a special night when I would just watch it by myself. And then that night finally came, I watched it, and I peed my pants, and it was an amazing revelatory experience for me, not just because it's one of the scariest things ever, but also because it was the first movie where I noticed a directorial stamp, even though, for one thing, when I was in the second grade, I wrote like a little essay about Steven Spielberg, so I was still well aware of that stuff, but it was the first time that I sort of noticed like a stylistic stamp and sort like the complex camera movements, that sort of thing. And it kind of blew my mind where like, wow, you could actually like do so much creative things with camera and mood and atmosphere and sense of place. And Jack Nicholson's performance back then, I thought it was like the best performance ever. Now I watch it and like, it's hammy, but you know, it's the best kind of hammy, but like I still think it's amazing, but for different reasons. And so yeah, that's basically how I found The Shining, and it's still one of my favorite movies of all time.
So there's so many things in there I want to just jump off of, but I'm going to start with this. I'm going to, just as a quick refresher, because I think my brain there are so many things in there, my brain already moved past. Did you say how old you exactly were when you had that DVR moment, when you were like, I'm watching this?
I was 13.
You were 13. Yeah. My brain is doing bad math and hearing the term DVR and 13 years old at the same time. I'm like, but hold on. My question to you is this.
It was in 2008.
2008. My question to you is this, right? What is it that came from what is it that the second grader writing a paper on Steven Spielberg is thinking at the point when The Shining comes in? Like he already had some interest and he was already digging into Spielberg. I don't know if that second grader was going off of love of E.T. and the light and Close Encounters of the Third Kind, the much friendlier Steven Spielberg. But when The Shining comes around, like, is it, like you said, I peed my pants, but
yeah,
is it something that you could relate to what you were seeing in Spielberg at that time?
Yeah, totally. Because whenever I think of Spielberg, I would, you know, obviously think of, you know, E.T. and Jurassic Park, which was another favorite of mine. And now that I think about it, Jurassic Park might have been like the first real horror movie that I've seen. So I guess if you consider that, because I remember well, not being scared, but like feeling very intense when I watched Jurassic Park when I was 8 years old, but it's technically not a horror movie. But yeah, I noticed like some things with like, but the only things I noticed in terms of like Spielberg's stamp was like his use of special effects. And I thought like, you know, I was really into that whole like movie magic sort of thing where like, you know, you're able to bring like, you know, an alien or a dinosaur to life. And that was part of what my paper was about. Though, to be fair, because I was a dumb 7 year old, basically what I did was I found this book and I was basically just like transcribing like what I read and learned from like that book that was about Steven Spielberg. And it was like, it was a tiny little book about like how Steven Spielberg started out like with television and the TV movie Duel and then moving on to like Jaws, which became a big hit and so on and so forth. So, yeah, and then I saw The Shining, and that sort of feeling came back, but on a more complex level, where it wasn't just, like, special effects that I was thinking about, but also I was thinking more critically about performances and atmosphere and camera placement and movement, and also just how, like, if it's possible to distill fear in like a cinematic form, which that movie does very, very well. And then it got me into like really considering how like movies are able to like distill these emotions that you can't really experience elsewhere, which is why I think the horror genre is so powerful, because fear is something that you don't often get in the real world, whereas something like, you know, you can experience lots of comedy in the real world and some drama and all that sort of thing, but horror is like totally unique, and it's just something that sort of really viscerally gets to you as a moviegoer. So yeah.
So okay, there's 13 year old you. Hiding away from your parents, watching this movie that you were told when they found you should not be watching. This. Yeah, what was that like when they found out that you were doing this? Was there a thing, or?
There was kind of a thing. I remember, like, this is going to be embarrassing to admit, but I watched I Am Legend on IMAX, and that was when I was, like, also 13 or 12 or something like that, and I really liked that movie and I wanted to get on DVD, but then they found out that I watched not just The Shining, but it was also at around that time that I also watched The Blair Witch Project for the first time, and that movie also terrified me. And so they found out that I watched these movies I wasn't supposed to watch, and then they said like they didn't, literally their only punishment that they could think of was to just like hold off like buying that DVD of I Am Legend for me, which is not that bad, but you know, it's not like watching an R-rated movie when you're not supposed to is a big crime that must be punished.
So okay, what was it like for you moving forward from that to the point in time where you and your parents are now kind of sharing movies together a little bit?
So I was now allowed to watch more R-rated movies, and my mom was very, very selective. Now we watch everything together. Like, I watched Melancholia with my mom. That was an interesting experience. And in the theater, no less.
Wow.
Yeah, I just dragged her into it. Like, hey, it's from the guy who made this movie about the clit snip, you know. So I just dragged her into it, and I remember we were just, like, in this theater, and maybe only a quarter of the seats were filled. It wasn't super crowded, but there were, like, you know, a fair amount of people, like maybe 12. And as the movie was going on, like half of them left by the time that Kirsten Dunst was cheating on her new husband on the day of her wedding. And they thought that, like, I couldn't handle this depressing bullshit anymore, and they just got up and left. And me, my mom, and two older ladies, and then like some other lady who was sitting in front of us were the only ones sitting there. But yeah, we now go to the movies a lot. And usually whenever I go to the movies, it's either with my friend Tyler or with my mom, or it's me alone, which I don't really mind that much.
So have you and your family always had this movie connection? Because I mean, yeah. I know you talked about having the slight restriction when you were younger, but even then, to eventually the point where they loosened on that restriction, it was always a together thing movies were for you and your family?
Yeah, because, you know, she never, most parents, like, I remember when I would watch lots of, like, movies and TV shows, there'd be those movies where the parents let their kids, like, run off and, like, just go do whatever, like, in the town. But me being an LA kid and it being a big city and all, I was very sheltered and I could never go anywhere without my mom. So, she would always, like, come with me whenever, like, we went to the movies or there would be a parental guardian, which was very, very rare. And we basically watched, like, just about every movie together, me and my mom. And very rarely my dad, too, because he's normally really busy. And now, I think the last movie I saw with my dad in the theater was either Spider-Man 3 or Pirates of the Caribbean 3. And that was a while ago, and my dad just, like, his work has been getting, you know, more and more hectic, so he's had even less time to go to a theater and see something either alone or with his family. So, actually that's wrong. The last movie I saw with my dad was The International, the Clive Owen movie. So just want to correct that. But, yeah. So it was always a family thing. It used to be also with my sisters, but not anymore because they're always doing stuff. But, one thing that my mom had was all of these VHSs. She had a lot of VHSs of Disney movies, like the old classic animated ones, including lots of straight-to-VHS Disney movies, which were terrible, but I liked them as a kid. And one movie, or one, like, bunch of movies that my mom had that... also could contribute to my love for cinema were Studio Ghibli movies, which I'm currently writing a retrospective on Studio Ghibli on Movie Mezzanine right now. And I believe the first one I watched was My Neighbor Totoro, and we watched that together, and that was sort of a revelatory experience for me as well. And then we saw Kiki's Delivery Service, and those were like the two Studio Ghibli movies that we watch, and it wasn't until I was 11 years old that I realized, wait, there's more, and then I saw Spirited Away, and that was also really awesome. But, so, yeah, it's always been this family thing for me, and I would always, I still see lots of movies with my mom, even though I'm in college and I'm not living at home anymore. But we still, the thing is, the college is not very far from home. It's actually, like, 15 minutes away, so much for being away from home. But we still go to movies a lot. Like, we just recently watched Philomena together, and that's a really good movie to watch with your mom. And it's always been a family thing.
So before we actually get back, because we haven't even started really, but to get before we get into the actual film itself and discussing the film, I'm curious, like, we already mentioned that you saw this at first when you were 13 years old and hiding away, your parents found out, they slightly punished you for doing this. I'm curious, slightly. like when you eventually cross that Rubicon of not being able to see movies like this and starting to and always having this moment with your family, have you yet, even though I'm assuming they've seen it, had a shared viewing experience of The Shining with your family?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. Now I watch it every Halloween. Now it's like, it's a new tradition.
I was ready to hear you say you're watching it every Christmas, and I'm like,
No, it's still a good Christmas movie. There's lots of snow, lots of family bonding. It's a great Christmas time family movie fun. But yeah, every Halloween I watch some of my favorite horror movies. I always start with The Shining, and then I would move on to some other horror movie that I really like. Like this year, I didn't have time to watch another horror movie, so I watched one that I never saw before, which was Wake and Fright, the Australian movie. That movie's nuts. But,
I've never heard of that one.
You should look it up. I shouldn't really explain it. But okay. Yeah, Wake and Fright is this old 70s Australian grindhouse movie that's kind of insane. Lots of kangaroo murder in that movie.
I'm afraid now. I'm very afraid.
Yeah, and apparently, yeah, kangaroos were harmed during the making of the film, so you're seeing actual kangaroo murder.
Now I don't even know if I want to sit through it knowing that. Like there's this thing with me and movies where no matter what's on the screen, like, I'm willing to tell myself, to get myself through it, that it's fake.
It's just a movie.
It's some way the guy has figured out how to do it to make it look as real as possible, right? But then now when I walk in knowing this horrible thing that you don't want to ever think about, it was actually kind of really done for this movie. I'm like, do I want to sit through that?
Yeah.
I don't know.
I mean, they did hire, like, you know, professional hunters to, like, help them out, and they had their permission to do it for the movie, but it's still kind of hard to watch. So, yeah. It's a crazy movie. You should check it out sometime if you want some, like, interesting kind of, like, psychological horror movie from the other end of the world. So, yeah. Wake and Fright.
Okay, so now, kind of, let's talk a little bit about The Shining as a film as it is, and I'm kind of curious, the only real description that you gave towards this movie and your experience watching it for the very first time was that you soiled yourself in a certain manner, if you allow me to use such terms.
Yeah, totally.
But I'm very curious, you talked about the directorial stamp, and this movie, it's a film which just fills you with awe. Like, even if you don't get to the fear section of that feeling, it just fills you with this moment of, there's something bigger here than what you might have seen in movies before.
Yeah, like, just some of the tracking shots of the hotel were, like, I was never wowed by, like, just shots of, like, you know, a building before. But then you go here and you have those bits of Danny Torrance riding on his tricycle. And the camera movement is smooth and fluid. But there's something sinister as well as beautiful about that as well. It's because it all culminates into that haunting sense of, you know, something is deeply wrong here. And it feels like we're kind of voyeuring in this family that's just living in this abandoned hotel for the winter. So, yeah, all that kind of stuff where I just noticed things like that and how these things that I normally take for granted in a cinema are all equally important and all part of a piece, and how, like, every single, especially in horror movies, every single thing from the sound design to angles and atmosphere and all of that is all important in its own way, and I started thinking more critically about that stuff ever since and after I watched The Shining.
One thing that I kind of took note of watching this movie, and I think it's something that most people do whenever they sit and watch Kubrick's films, because I guess it's something that's kind of bad to say, like kind of posh to say when it comes to movie discussions, but there is sort of a separate mode of thought that you give certain movies once you know certain people are directing or who had a hand in making the movie. But there's a certain way in which Kubrick frames this movie, and it's the fact that throughout the entire film, like the moment that we end up with a character moment, there are moments where we're outside and we're looking at the hotel, but whenever we're sitting with Jack, or we're sitting with Danny, or even with Wendy, or we notice for some reason that Kubrick loves to center them in the frame perfectly.
Yeah, symmetry.
Right, and I started out feeling that this was going to be a thing where he was going to keep them centered until towards the last third of the movie, when things start to get a bit more insane and we're going to start to see them move off kilter, but they never do. And I'm trying to figure out if there is a, at least in your mind, if there's a real deep reasoning as to why symmetry was so important to Kubrick, because while we have the reality versus the ghosts, the hotel versus outside of the hotel, we never really take stock of why these characters are never really are kind of left in their own space as in the frame whenever we're watching them.
Yeah. The more I think about it, it's like, I remember another thing that The Shining did that was very influential to me was it directed me to Roger Ebert's writing, and he wrote this great, you know, great movies article where, you know, he lists all of his the movies that he considers the great movies, and he makes like little articles on them, puts them in a list of the great movies. And The Shining was on there, and he had this very interesting interpretation of the film that I've always sort of clung to, which is that almost every single character in the movie is an unreliable narrator, not just Jack Torrance as played by Jack Nicholson, but also a Danny, because his perception of things is off kilter from like his psychic abilities, I guess, you know, his ability to
shine.
Yeah, the shining. Yeah, exactly. And then you've got Wendy, who like you'd think would be like the most reliable, except for the fact that she's just plunged deep into despair and just is always crying, always weeping. And that could sort of influence perception as well. The closest thing we do have to a reliable narrator is Scatman Crothers as he's
Dick.
The chef. Dick Halloran, yeah, now I remember. And the thing is, he has The Shining too, but he's more of an adult. You'd think that he has more control and he might know what's going on, but his perception is obviously like taken away when, you know, spoiler alert for The Shining.
Oh, don't worry about that.
Year old movie. he dies. Always the black guy. Always the black guy. Yeah, not even Stanley Kubrick can transcend the cliche of the black guy always dies first. Not even Kubrick.
Do we get to use the excuse that there are lots of ghosts who are in the movie? Do we get to use that excuse?
Well, he's the first one that dies on screen.
Okay.
So, but okay, we'll accept that. We'll accept that. Just for the purposes of this. But, yeah, also another thing that I can't believe I forgot to mention this. The Shining is the first time I saw boobs in the theater. Or, no, not in the theater, but on screen. So, yeah, there's that, too.
It was kind of weird. I was rewatching this movie today, and like my father came by, and he loves this movie, right? And he loves it for the reason most people love it, which is why he loves Jack Nicholson and all of the wonderful Jack Nicholson moments of this movie. And like I paused it to have a little conversation with him about something. And the moment I paused it on was the moment where Jack is in room 237 and the woman is just standing up there full nude. And I just left it paused there. And I thought for a moment, like 15 years ago, this would have probably been the most awkward moment that I could think of. But it's just weird now that this is okay for me. As we're having this random conversation while there's just a woman with boobs in front of me, I'm like, okay. Talking about movies that deal with unreliable narrators and all of the characters in it, I found it really odd to think about it that we're discussing a horror movie which has a child with supernatural abilities and he's not the real monster of the movie.
That's what I love about it, is that even though there are ghosts and paranormal activities going on in The Shining, the real monster is just a regular, normal guy, and that's, you know, Jack Torrance. And that's what Stephen King's novel, The Shining, was, like, mainly concerned about, was how horror can lurk even in the confines of a traditional American family and a traditional American dad. And how, like, that sort of image can falter when in the presence of the unknown or, like, the unknowable or just or also alcoholism, which was a main theme in Stephen King's book, but not so much in Kubrick's work, where it's just another plot point that contributes to this tale of madness and insanity. But you mentioned earlier about how, like, the characters are always at the center of the frame. And the more I think about it, the more I think that the reason why a lot of times characters are always at the center of the frame, there's lots of symmetry, is that it gives this feeling of always the characters always being boxed in. And because whenever you think of a Kubrick movie, there's always that sense of his really authoritative control he has over every single part of the movie and these characters. And he's like, you know, a perfectionist. He has like that high IQ and he's very meticulous with all the details he puts. And because of that, it's easy for like the humanity of these projects to be kind of trapped And I feel like Kubrick kind of knows this, so he sort of knowingly puts these characters in a box where they're surrounded by all sides by something that is always like taking up more of the space or just as much of the space as they are. And that claustrophobia and that sense of not being in control is especially effective in a horror film, and which is why it's kind of sad that Kubrick hasn't done much in the way of horror. You could argue that Full Metal Jacket, it has some horrifying scenes in them, as does A Clockwork Orange, and Eyes Wide Shut has thriller elements as well, but The Shining is his only like real like entry into the genre, and it's where like those abilities as a director truly, or at least fully, take shape for me.
Talking about Kubrick and his weird control, I shouldn't say weird, his, as you put it, this
very
this
meticulous
control over everything that goes into his films, not just story, narrative, or anything, but just imagery wise. There's one moment, like, if anyone talks about Kubrick films, there are always going to be a handful or more of moments that kind of just leave you just in, I already mentioned it, in awe of what people can put in movies, put on the screen for you. But there's this one moment which kind of got me, and even right now I'm still kind of thinking about it as to figure out, and this is something that I feel that all the great films kind of do to me, I start to question how they actually did it, like whether it was real, whether they miniaturized it or whatever. There's this moment when you see Wendy and Danny going through the maze, and it dissolves over to Jack in the hotel, and then he goes over to like this miniature of the whole maze where he's just looking down on it, and then it cuts immediately to an above shot of that entire maze. But you can still see Danny, and what's supposed to be Danny and Wendy, walking around in the middle of the maze. And I start to question, which maze are we actually being filmed? Because realistically, it would make more sense to do the miniature, and you'd get all of that detail that he wants, but you wouldn't have gotten Danny and Wendy in there. But if you, the only way to get Danny and Wendy there was to do the actual maze, but he'd have to have the camera at such a height that I don't believe he would have gotten that detail or anything, even if to just get it to that height. And I'm kind of left in this point of just questioning whether it was shot A or shot B. And I'm just, and that is something which I really value going into a Kubrick film, where I'm just left aghast at what he can put on screen
me. That's a brilliant shot. And I remember that even Michael Phillips of the Chicago Tribune, like he, when they were doing a retrospective review of this movie on the Film Spotting podcast, even he mentioned that shot, and even he was wondering like, how did they do it? And I feel like it's kind of obvious that what we're supposed to be looking at is the miniature, except we're seeing, you know, Wendy and Danny there, and they look almost like, you know, these toys that are, and then you have Jack Torrance just looming over them like some godly omnipotent presence, which in some ways could be reflective of Kubrick's domineering omnipotent presence towards the entire movie. But I still don't know how they did it, but I kind of like to guess as to like how they could have done it, where maybe they just had maybe they just had some above takes of Danny and Wendy running around, except they super miniaturized them and overlaid them on the shot of the miniature maze. But even then, I can never know for sure, because I don't even know if anyone outside of the production knows how he did that. And I've never heard or at least seen an article or anything that explains how they did that. So that's always been an interesting little mystery among many in The Shining.
Are there any moments in this movie besides that particular shot that kind of leave you in that same feeling of just amazingness that he can actually put that on screen for us to see?
I always adored the shot of the blood coming out of the elevator. And it's just such an incredible, like, it's not just disgusting, but also kind of beautiful in its own way, where the blood is not gooey, like red corn syrupy kind of blood, even though it obviously is. But the way it just flows out of those red elevator doors, it looks almost like rose petals opening up. And there's something like kind of beautiful and majestic about it until you realize what that actually is. And then the fear jumps at you and you realize this is not something beautiful. This is something that we should be very afraid of. And the movie kind of tricked you into being enveloped into this image only to sort of like pull the rug out from under you and catch you in this state of terror and fear, which in some ways, like, Kubrick uses like that sort of directorial beauty to his advantage to sort of undercut the audience, where you feel kind of absorbed and yet at the same time repelled in this story and like these images, and you want to stare at them and yet you also want to look away because of how terrifying. And this is especially true in that scene in Room 237, which is the most obvious example of this, where you have Jack leering at this naked woman that's in a tub and he starts making out with her, and he is just fallen into Kubrick's trap. And then all of a sudden the lady who was beautiful and naked just disintegrates and turns into this saggy, decrepit old lady who's just laughing maniacally. And that's basically the whole movie in a nutshell, just Kubrick sort of pulling you in through skill and then completely undertaking that by introducing the fear factor. And that's the power of cinema, that you could do that.
I think the last thing that I intentionally noticed Kubrick laying into this movie had to do with something that most people, I think, don't really pay attention to that much in movies when they watch them, and that's actually the scene-to-scene transitions. And it felt weirdly right that Kubrick decided that on every proper scene-to-scene transition that he used an actual dissolve that made all of the characters have this ghostly feeling to themselves, feeling moving into one scene, moving out of one scene into another, when we're completely talking about ghost stories. And I mean, why is it that this tiny thing, because it's something that I guess filmmakers just take for granted sometimes, that they don't really know what to do with. It feels like it's such a standard mode of operation that it no longer becomes a thing that you can really play with that much.
Yeah, I recently watched Nebraska earlier today, and that's a good movie. I recommend it. But I remember there's this one scene where there is a transition, a wipe transition. And it's the only time Alexander Payne ever uses a wipe transition in that entire movie. And I was just left there wondering, why did he use the wipe transition there? And I couldn't really figure out like what he was going for by using that wipe transition, other than, oh, maybe he was just kind of lazy and decided to sort of throw it in there. I have no idea. Maybe someone else who likes the movie better than me can figure out what Alexander Payne was thinking, just having this random wipe transition in the movie. So yeah, it is like transitions in general are something that are kind of taken for granted. And I always find it weird whenever a movie sort of misuses that. It's a little pet peeve of mine. It kind of bothers me. But yeah, in The Shining, that whole sense of the characters just sort of fading ghostily through like each scene is very important, because like I said earlier, like there is no reliable narrator. For all we know, all of these characters could just be ghosts. Who knows? There's really no way we could tell. Maybe they all froze to death in that. Really, the only thing that we get is that we have these shots of the radio men who are sort of outside the hotel, and Wendy's talking to them like via radio. But even then, because there is no reliable narrator, can we trust Wendy's perception as well? And then Scatman Crothers comes in, and then we think he might have all the answers until he's murdered. And our sense of comprehension or cohesion, that our sense of wanting to know the answers, is defeated when Scatman Crothers, as Dick Halloran, just is murdered. And it's also sort of important in the sense that I remember, I forget, was at Fantastic Fest or something like that, there is this thing called The Shining Backwards and Forwards, where they just played like two different projections of The Shining, and one was playing forwards and one was playing backwards, and they were overlaid on top of each other simultaneously. And then when people, it was a weird experiment that when people watched it, there'd be these weird coincidences where scenes would transition at the same time, even though they were at different points in the movie. And not only that, but then there would also be some images overlaid on top of each other that just made so much thematic sense that they couldn't have been accidental. Like a shot of the twin girls, the creepy twin girls who are just like murdered, covered in blood, and there's an axe thrown in the ground. And that's the forwards version. And then the backwards version that's overlaid on top of that is a shot of Jack Torrance just staring madly at something off camera. And it looks like he is like this ghostly presence that is like overlaid on top of the shot of the murdered twin girls. And I don't even know where to begin with that. That's just creepy. It might just be like some scary coincidence because the world just works in mysterious ways, but there's Stanley Kubrick was a weird guy.
So like you see, here lies this weird part of my brain where there are two versions of this in my brain, right? I want to laugh at the people who do this to themselves, who do things like that, where they play the movie backwards and forwards overlaid. And
like, how did they get that idea? Like, you know what we should do? And then they just did that.
And
try to
find all of this hidden meaning in everything that happens to coincide, and that there's a Stanley Kubrick up in the heavens, if there is a heavens or whatever,
he's
looking
laughing down
and laughing at them, going, oh my goodness, I never thought that would have ever happened. And there's another part of my brain which imagines Stanley Kubrick pulling his hair out in the editing room trying to make this thing happen, because in his brain he's like, this is going to make so much sense when someone does this.
It's like, it's all part of his master plan. It's like the National Treasure of cinema. Stanley Kubrick is our Dan Brown.
Oh man. I think I want Stanley Kubrick pulling out his hair, because it makes more sense.
It makes more sense.
In the version of Stanley Kubrick we all try to remember.
Yeah. But all the mysteries are just out in the grave with him, and it's all up to Nicolas Cage to discover them.
Oh no, but Harvey Keitel has to come and help him out too.
Oh yeah, totally. And also Diane Kruger.
Oh, let's just keep naming people in
National Treasure. Let's just make National Treasure 3, the American cinema version.
What else was there? I was just thinking, and I don't know if you're even watching this, but recently I found myself to be watching American Horror Story, and I'm watching.
I'm watching that.
The first season.
That's my
seen
favorite
anymore.
Guilty pleasure.
And I found it kind of weird to me watching American Horror Story now, which is a show that I know pulls from a lot of pop culture and a lot of not just
more
horror,
like everything,
but everything, right? But I found it kind of interesting thinking about this in American Horror Story fashion as to how much this hotel as a horror location plays so much like the first season of American Horror Story is playing for me right now. And it just kind of feels nice. I don't know how else to put it. I'm sure for you, since you're obviously a big fan of this show, watching that show at that point in time, you were like, oh, so I need to watch The Shining now.
Yeah, especially because season one is the murder house season, and that the way that house is constructed, it feels very like Kubrick-esque, where just the architecture and the stairs just sort of zigzagging and all that stuff, it feels like very much like a cribbing of The Shining. And this is especially apparent in actually, now I think about it, every season of American Horror Story has some sort of building that's like that, where season two they had the asylum, which feels very much like The Overlook, but with crazy people in them, and also Nazis, because American Horror Story. And then season three has, like, you know, the coven, and their secret base is this mansion that also has some Overlook-ian touches to them. And Man, I can't believe that I still haven't seen that documentary, Room 237, because I love The Shining, and I always love, like, hearing weird, crazy theories about it, but I've also heard lots of mixed things about the documentary as well. I really want to get around to that, especially by the time that this year is over, but I'm curious as to, like, you know, what other, like, weird theories out there, because of just how, like, Stanley Kubrick's sort of influence, that sort of image we have of Stanley Kubrick as this crazed genius who is always overworking every single little detail in all of his movies. And yeah, I haven't seen the movie yet, but I really want to someday.
Ditto to that. I was actually kind of half hoping to see Room 237 before
it we talked. It is on Netflix Instant.
It is on Netflix Instant, and I was going to watch it, but damn me and time today.
Yeah. And also, I have, like, so much other movies to catch up on for this year. Like, yeah.
Always movies to catch up on. I'm very much doing the same right now. But I'm actually, now that we're starting to talk more about Kubrick as what we imagine him to be, it makes me think more and more about our obsession with filmmakers and how we kind of perceive them and how it eventually pushes onto how we want to perceive their work. And it kind of, it pushes me, like, very much into that moment of questioning people, doing crazy things with people's films, overlaying them and such. It pushes me into two minds where I'm like, yes, that's probably the right way to look at it, or we're completely overthinking this and they're just standing up there laughing at us doing this shit all the while.
Yeah, that's sort of like, that's always kind of the worry that you have when it comes to interpreting movies and visual symbolism. But at the same time, that's an important thing to do because art is something that affects people in different ways. And it's always nice to sort of try and figure out exactly why that is. Like maybe the reason why someone would think that The Shining is an allegory for why the moon landing is fake or something like that, which is insane, I must add. But maybe the reason why is because, like, The Shining must have... Because the thing is, like, movies not only work on that visually symbolic level, also on a subliminal level, where just, like, the tiniest image, no matter, like, even if it's played for just a fraction of a second, could trigger these emotions and images in your head. And when you're dealing with a guy like Stanley Kubrick, who is always, where every single thing about his method is intentional, then, like, it's easy to see why someone would overinterpret a movie like The Shining.
And then, I mean, talking about people who overinterpret The Shining and all of this intentional filmmaking, I mean, when you see that pretty much throwaway moment when everything goes batshit crazy and Wendy goes up the stairs to look into this room to see the let me call him a furry because we don't know what it is, but we assume it's a
basically
person.
Basically a furry.
What looks like he's going down on this guy.
Because apparently furries existed in the 80s before the internet.
Yes. It's this moment where everyone seems to just focus on. Like, any time nowadays that I'm seeing someone on the internet writing about The Shining, that's still always... image they're going to be using on their post.
Yeah, because that's, like, you could find, like, certain, like, there's a scene with the skeletons, and I'm like, oh, skeletons, because they're scary. There's a scene with the blood coming from the elevator, like, oh, blood, a horror movie thing. But then you get to the bear that's blowing off that dude, and you have to wonder why. Just why. Because I remember I read Stephen King's The Shining a couple of years after I've watched the movie for the first time, and I remember there was a scene where there were these hedge animals that were near the maze. Then the hedge animals basically came to life, and, you know, they couldn't do that in a 1980s movie because that would take way too much effects work that didn't exist back then. So, like, maybe Stanley Cooper was trying to be creative and finding other animal-related means of scaring people. He thought, maybe he just thought of a random scene of a guy in a bear suit sucking off someone else. But Yeah, it's always funny when you hear those words, like, overlay on top of each other, but...
and that bitch happens to overlay when you play the movie backwards to when Danny's just sitting in a room. He's probably thinking about that.
What could it mean? Maybe Danny's gonna grow up to be a furry. Maybe that's what Dr. Sleep is about. That sequel that Stephen King wrote.
It's weird. Dr. Sleep. That this is one of the few Stephen King books that I've read, and I can barely remember how I compare this to the movie. All I remember is the movie.
Yeah, exactly, because the movie is so much better in every way. And not only that, but I watched, or not watched the whole way through, but I've watched the majority of that TV miniseries that Stephen King made of The Shining, which is pretty bad, but it's much closer to the book. And they finally do have those CGI hedge animals, and they look terrible. They look atrocious. And that's why Stanley Kubrick was smart in just focusing mostly on practical effects, because those are not going to age. Because that scene of the blood just coming out of the elevator is always going to be scarier than, say, those hedge animals. Yeah, I'll just go back to those again, because those are just bad.
I'm actually afraid of having that conversation with someone who watches this movie and goes, yeah, that blood scene, meh.
Yeah. The thing is, that probably does exist.
It does.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember, I haven't watched 237, Room 237, but I remember, wasn't there a theory that, that the movie is supposed to be some allegory about, like, the Indians or the Navajo or something like that? Maybe that's what the bear symbolizes.
I have no idea about those things.
I am so looking for needles in haystacks regarding that bear scene. Just that bear scene, though. It's just...
There's nothing else where you're like, I need to know the meaning of this.
Like, that and the maze scene are always going to be the eternal mysteries of The Shining. Oh, along with the final shot.
Yeah. Because, I mean, even, like, alright, talking about that final shot, like, it's something where I start to question, like, how you said, like, is it a quick case where all that we've been watching is, like, some ghosts playing out some mystery in their ghost lives, or did Jack Torrance actually time travel back to the 20s in some sense?
Or in a sense that, like, maybe the theory that I like to hear, and it's a very poetic string of words, and I didn't come up with it because I'm too stupid to come up with great writing like that, but that the hotel maybe absorbed him into the past, because that's just what it does, because it's some creepy, haunted, mysterious hotel that just absorbs people into the past. And maybe all of those people in that photo we see are other victims. Who knows?
That's very true, because I was actually thinking about that, because throughout this movie, for the most part, anytime we actually saw a ghost, we could walk into the belief that this ghost had something to do with dying within the hotel premises. I mean, the first thing I think we see happens to be the two children, which we know because we heard the story. We end up seeing that lady in room 237, and because of the way that we see her body eventually, we just kind of assume, okay, so she died in the hotel somehow. And then everyone afterwards, we just kind of walk in with that assumption, even when we see Lloyd at the bar. But yeah. Then there's this point where Jack walks into the bar room, the gold room,
I think.
The gold room.
Yeah, it's that big ballroom, and they're having a party.
He just sees everyone there, and at that point, we just kind of have to walk in assuming everyone there died, especially when we finally meet the guy who was the caretaker, who ended up killing those two children and his wife and such in that gruesome story that we're told early on in the film. So therefore, I guess the whole absorption into the past, into that image, kind of makes the most sense logically.
Yeah, and not only that, it also makes the most sense thematically as well, because this whole movie rides on characters being absorbed into, like, their past selves, because we've got Jack Torrance, who is trying to quit his drinking and alcoholism, and he has a history of abusing, physically abusing Danny, his kid. He's trying to be a better person, but he can't. He is always, he's just thrown back into his old primal self, and this family is just brought back to those past aggressions in this hotel room. And not only that, you could also argue, I guess, if we're going to be super analytical about man just regressing back to their most primal animalistic states, which can also be thematic of, you know, being absorbed back into the past. And not only that, but, that old adage that those who forget the past are doomed to repeat it. And then you've got like this incident that happened in the past literally happening again. So it's always been the theory that I like to cling onto the most out of all of them, even though I recognize that there are lots of other like great ones out there.
Yeah. But anyways, I think we might have just hit that wall when it comes to trying to define The Shining. But before we go...
And the thing that's great about it is that it can't be defined with simple terms. And it's great that a movie can do that and inspire so much discussion.
Yeah. Like, that's always what I look for in a film. Like, more than anything else. More than what it means to me. More than what it means to someone else. More than box office numbers or whatever. Is the fact that it actually spurns on, like, an interesting discussion to be had. But I'm kind of curious for you, since you've spent so many years idealizing and wondering about The Shining, is there anything else that you'd like to comment or bring up on about this film that we haven't discussed specifically too?
I feel like we've gone through a lot of the big stuff, really.
Including your interest in furries.
Oh... I'm not, I don't even have words to respond to that. I just, furries.
So that was the podcast. I hope you guys enjoyed the conversation. I definitely did. Because guys, furries. There's furries in this movie. Anyways, what was I going to say? There are a few things I should mention. As always, you should go follow, rate, subscribe, listen to the podcast. You can go do that over on iTunes. Just search for the Movies You Love podcast and you'll find it. Or you can click the link in the post over at gmanreviews.com where the site is hosted. You can follow me on Twitter. I am at gmanreviews. And always enjoy. But I should... make a note, because coming to the end of the year, in a few days it'll be Christmas, guys. It'll be Christmas, and Merry Christmas to you guys if you're just hearing this around the Christmas season. Happy New Year if you're listening to it at that point. But this will not be the end of the Movies You Love podcast. I'm working on something special for the end of the year, and I hope you guys are looking forward to it. I think I might have mentioned it once or twice here or there. But yeah, it's looking to turn out to be something interesting. I was worried about how big it was going to be, how awesome it was going to be. Every week I'm seeing a new email coming and I'm like, yes, it's going to be great. And I want to just take a moment to thank every single person. I'm probably going to do this again in that episode. I want to thank every single person who's listened, who's rated, who's subscribed, and especially those who came on and spoke with me over this last year. This is episode number 19. So there have been 19 people willing to give me an hour, some of them an hour and a half, of their time to talk about movies. And that's kind of insane in my brain. Like, 5 years ago I started this website, now I'm like, whoa, like I should just do this kind of more amazingly. And I don't want to toot my own horn, I don't want to flatter myself that much, but I'm kind of happy with what I've created here so far. And I hope you guys are too. If you're listening, I really hope you are, because I'd be sad if you're just not happy with it and you're just listening kind of begrudgingly. Anyways, this is a long outro. Once again, thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the show, and
if you have any comments or anything, let me know. And once again, rate, subscribe, review on iTunes. You can also listen through Stitcher, and always you can listen over at gmanreviews.com. And you can also listen to my other podcast, the Unnamed Movie Podcast, which I do with my friends Douglas and Damien, which is also over at gmanreviews.com or through iTunes. I refuse to stop this outro. Will I stop this outro? I think I'm going to stop it right now.